Prolonged war in the Middle East is having all too predictable consequences to the refugee crisis affecting millions and the hundreds of thousands of casualties from the battlefield in Syria. We must now add that the public health situation in the Middle East, and particularly Syria, seems to be deteriorating, reverting to some of the worst times reported since the last century. A polio outbreak in Syria, the first in country for 14 years. It's just the beginning of health effects that will take years to reverse and require renewed cooperation of the international community. Joining me now is David Miliband, president of the International Rescue Committee and Britain's former foreign secretary. Welcome to the program.
Thank you. It's good to be here.
So how urgent is this situation in Syria right now? It's certainly not without prediction. We could have predicted that there would be health impacts from a two-year-long civil war, but what are you seeing?
Well, we've got an unprecedented regional crisis. Remember, after the Soviet invasion of Afghanistan, that was a country that dissolved. Here you've got Syria and the four neighbors, Lebanon, Turkey, Jordan and Iraq, all consumed by the dissolution of Syria. Population 22 million, 8, 9, 10 million of them on the move, most of them inside the country, but 2 million refugees outside the country, predicted to be 3 million, and the kind of descent into hell that you're describing, polio, typhoid, people starving, there are reports. We, the International Rescue Committee, have got about, we're serving about 800,000 people with healthcare inside Syria, and all the reports back are of an absolutely terrible situation in which people are literally demanding life-saving interventions, whether it be medical aid or food. And of course, there's winter coming. And people think of the Middle East as being hot, but come December, it's sub-zero in the Middle East and or in the Syrian part of the Middle East. And so we've got the added danger that goes with a winter that will be cold and dangerous.
I mean, what you're seeing regionally is a reversion to conditions that we really haven't seen region-wide since, you know, the 30s and 40s. I mean, these are countries that have seriously industrialized, have urbanized, have upgraded their education systems, and yet we're seeing such a quick reversal. Does that surprise you and other NGOs?
Well, I think that Syria was obviously a middle-income country until quite recently. There's never been anything quite like the dissolution, the descent into hell that we're seeing at the moment. I think from an NGO perspective, when you think about a civil war that's consuming large parts of the population and you think about the closeness of the countries around Syria, then it's not surprising that you're going to get this kind of danger. What is different this time is the failure of the international community to make its presence felt. The deadlock, the political deadlock at the United Nations over the last 2 years has not just been about the big political issues of whose side you're on. It's also about being about the humanitarian questions. So civilians and aid workers have been targeted in this conflict in a way that they haven't been for many, many decades. And that obviously sets a terrible precedent.
I'm wondering if the legacy of the Arab-Israeli conflict and the legacy of oil are partly to blame in the sense that people feel as though, well, they can take care of themselves on the one hand, or the divisions are such that there's no way to really weigh in and help the region generally without taking sides.
I think it's certainly true if you mean why is the West standing back. I think in Western publics and Western governments there's a very strong sense that this is an incredibly complex tinderbox. Really. But that doesn't, in our view, in my view, excuse the failure to engage on humanitarian basis, because the innocent civilians, remember, there are 300,000 children, Syrian children, in Lebanon next door. The Lebanese education system after the age of 11 is taught in French, not in Arabic. You've got a whole generation of kids there, and they're not going to be going home anytime soon. They appeal to our hearts, but also to our brains. We should know that in the modern world, if you allow problems like that to fester, then there's only problems that will in the end rebound on you.
You referenced Afghanistan, talking about the dissolution of that country after the Soviet invasion, and we know what happened then. With all of the various countries involved here, you're really looking at a hotbed of chaos that could have political consequences way beyond simply the health consequences.
I mean, I've talked about the danger of a decade of disorder. President Obama said that we're coming to the end of a decade of war. The danger is that we have a decade of disorder in some fragile, conflict-ridden states. And it is extraordinary if you think about it. There are fewer wars than for hundreds of years. It's a relatively peaceful world. But there are more refugees than ever before, 45 million last year. And so you've got this dissonance, this contrast between generalized prosperity and stability, which is affecting more and more countries, including in Africa and parts of the developing world, but these undergoverned spaces where there isn't a proper accountable government, where ethnic and tribal ties are growing and are growing in importance, and where no one's really holding the ring. Those are the disorder spots of the 21st century. And of course, the danger is that it can affect us all because we live in an interdependent world. And you know that better than any others, given the Afghan experience.
Regional players, can the Saudis play a role, or are they discredited because of their own allegiances? The Turks, are they discredited because of some of the ideological problems that we've already seen from the Turkish government? Are the Jordanians too weak to take the lead here?
I think you've got to look to regional players, and the question isn't really should they be doing something. They are engaged. The Jordanians are engaged because of the mass exodus of Syrians into their country. Remember, the number of Syrian refugees in Jordan is the equivalent, more or less, of the whole of Poland coming to America. Jordan has a population of about 5.5 million. It's already got 600,000 refugees. That's why, in percentage terms, it's like 35, 40 million Poles coming to the US. So Jordan is dependent on what's going on. But you're right, the Turks have been appealing for more action. They're taking it themselves. The Saudis have been taking action too. And the absence of an international consensus has created a vacuum in which all these players are doing their own thing.
The UN should take the lead. What's the first sort of step that you would look to have actual tangible benefits on?
Well, obviously,
ground?
Everyone's very relieved that the chemical weapons issue seems to be dealt with. The danger is that we forget hundreds of thousands who've been killed by conventional weapons, the 7, 8, 9 million who are displaced. I think the UN has to be the focal point for that, and it has to step up not just on the chemical weapons issue, but it also has to step up on the protection of civilians, the delivery of aid. And in the end, if the UN can't do it, it's much, much harder for individual countries to do it. I would say that NGOs are often the risk takers and the pioneers, getting aid to places where it's too dangerous to go, taking innovative solutions like delivering cash to some communities in Lebanon, where, of course, there are no refugee camps. These in Lebanon, 700,000 refugees living in urban communities. And so you need the NGO mix as well as the leadership of the UN.
Well, best of luck on a very challenging set of problems. David Miliband, president of the International Rescue Committee, former foreign secretary.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, sir.